The military commissions are still a very active bunch of institutions in 1866. There are still lots and lots of soldiers, Union soldiers in the American South. The Klan has been created in the same year, and white Southern violence in a kind of guerrilla-like warfare is starting to resume. The Confederate armies are famous for not resorting to guerrilla warfare. Lee and folks like that disown it at the end of the war. But the Klan is a form of guerrilla warfare starting up again. And so the Union Army and its authority to do justice in the Reconstruction South, and this is pre-congressional Reconstruction. This is white Southern governments that have been readmitted by Andrew Johnson. They're not going to do the work of policing violence against the recently freed people. And so the military commission is the hope for a whole group of folks in the North as something that will make emancipation real.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 24th, 2019. Jack Goldsmith sat down with John Fabian Witt, professor of law at Yale Law School. The two talked about Witt's new book, To Save the Country, which features a previously undiscovered manuscript written by Francis Lieber, a legal advisor to Lincoln's White House and key thinker in the development of American laws of war. Witt explained Lieber's impact on the development of American wartime law and talked about what the manuscript has to say about Lieber's views on martial law and his unorthodox understanding of military necessity. The two also discussed the famous Reconstruction-era military commission's precedent, Ex parte Milligan, Lieber's anxieties about congressional power, and more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 455. Jack Goldsmith and John Fabian Witt on To Save the Country.
So I'm here with John Witt today of Yale Law School, and we're at the Yale Law School to talk about his new book called To Save the Country, A Lost Treatise on Martial Law. It is a book that is really, the bulk of the book is written by Francis Lieber and his son Norman Lieber. And John and Will Smiley edited the manuscript, basically excavated the manuscript, and then they offer a long and very interesting introduction that frames what the Liebers wrote. So, thanks, John.
Hi, thanks.
So, who is Francis Lieber and who is Norman Lieber? Many of our Lawfare listeners will know, but some won't.
Great. So, Francis Lieber is a Prussian immigrant to the United States during the antebellum period, who by good fortune and by good strategy found himself as a key legal advisor to the Lincoln administration during the war, most famously produces the what's known as the Lieber Code, General Orders Number 100, published in the spring of 1863, which sets out a code for the laws of armed conflict. And then Guido Norman Lieber, his son, is during the war a judge advocate, and then after the war becomes judge advocate general of the United States.
Okay, could you just sort of to set up this document that you found? Could you just give us a little bit of background on General Orders 100? What purpose it served and what its position is, and Lieber's position, Francis Lieber's position in the history of the laws of war.
Yeah, so the Lieber Code's been known since it was published, and has throughout the last 150 years been thought of, especially by American military lawyers, as a foundational document in international humanitarian law. It's 150 some odd articles, and it's got rules for torture of prisoners of war and civilians and military necessity. It's got all the stuff that makes up the contemporary discussion of the laws of armed conflict in it. My book, Lincoln's Code, from a couple years ago, took the position that the occasion for it was emancipation and the arming of black soldiers. And that's why, for the first time in modern military history, a code like that needed to be promulgated, because the Lincoln administration was taking controversial arguments that ran headlong into American precedent on what the laws of armed conflict allowed in the Civil War. So that's been my argument about the occasion for the code. Others see different reasons for it. There's guerrilla warfare controversies in places like Missouri and elsewhere. There are lots of law of war controversies going on, and the code is the Union's effort to clarify what the standards will be.
Just a few more thoughts on that. Why was this the moment? Was it because Lincoln was interested in law? Was it because the Union, I mean, you just gave one reason related to emancipation. But why was there something about this moment historically, other than the particulars you just mentioned?
Yeah, well, there are a million interesting things. I mean, communications technologies, literacy. I mean, so the telegraph is on board, which means that audiences in London are learning about atrocities in the Crimea in the 1850s. Images of horrors in the Civil War are being spread around in the Northern press. The CNN effect in an early version is there. And at the same time, you have an officer class that can read, that's spread out in a decentralized army, and you can send them a pamphlet that's got dozens and dozens of pages, and it's complicated, and they can read it and digest it and use it mostly for managing prisoners. Yeah. It's not a targeting thing. It's not that Sherman in Atlanta is trying to figure out, can I fire this way? Right. But you can send it to officers who are literate. So there's a military history piece, but the Springfield rifle is important to this because it means that all of a sudden you have the capacity to fire at long distance. You can spread your army out. You can be decentralized. You're not fighting in Napoleonic infantry squares. So there's a whole bunch of things. You know, Crimea doesn't produce one of these things. The Mexican War doesn't produce one of these things. Those are some of the reasons why I focused on the emancipation piece of it.
Okay, that was your last book, and it was a great book. This book is different. This book is about a different document. What is this document?
So in the course of doing that research, I encountered in the judge advocate papers in the National Archives, in the Philippines materials from the occupation of the Philippines and the insurgency and counterinsurgency there around the turn of the 20th century, I encountered in Guido Norman Lieber's papers these folders that had this mass of undigested material. And it was chaos. It was just page after page of scribble, furiously intricate, lots of footnotes being dropped, daggers and asterisks. And at first I just pushed past it because, well, historians with time constraints, oftentimes you push past something. And then I came back to it because I knew that after the spring of 1863, Francis Lieber had been pushing to produce a second edition of the Lieber Code. He wanted General-in-Chief Henry Halleck to promulgate that as a subsequent order with some things clarified. There are some funny mistakes in the Lieber Code, which he would like embarrassingly afterwards to fix. So I knew he'd been working on a new text. And I also knew that in the immediate wake of the war, from his correspondence and also from some published fragments in the 1870s, that he had been producing a longer text on emergencies and martial law. And so I started to wonder if that was the thing. And I came to conclude that it was a complicated version of all the things he'd been writing in the wake of the war.
So you talked in this, in the great introduction to the book about, correct me if I'm wrong, but how, as you just said, the project after General Orders 100 kind of expanded and got more ambitious, and he continued to work on it and make it larger during his life. But you also just tell us a word about these weren't the most organized scholars in the world. I mean, what was the shape of this larger document that you found? Because you just said you weren't really sure what you had.
Right. So it was a couple hundred manuscript pages, disordered, different handwritings through it. By the end, my co-editor, Will Smiley, at the University of New Hampshire, and I concluded that there were at least three different handwritings in it, probably the hands of Francis Lieber, although his hand is the least common in the manuscript, his son, Guido Norman, and then someone who must have been a secretary or something who's doing some transcriptions. That last handwriting was the easiest one to read. And what we did was try to cull together, combine, and collect all those pages. And we ended up thinking we had two different documents, both of which are in this book. One is an annotated version of the Lieber Code. It's an incomplete fragment of an annotated version that expands. Lieber liked to talk, and he wrote. He was a verbose.
Francis,
Francis was just voluminous in the use of language. He wrote hundreds of letters. His letters at the one of the most important roles for him in history is he's a correspondent. And so American historians have long used his letters, not to write about him, but to write about all the people he's writing with at the Huntington Library. They're just a real treasure. And so he just writes like a madman. And
But it sounds like in an undisciplined way.
Totally undisciplined. I mean, you can see that even in the published code. General Orders 100 is not a disciplined lawyer's document. And its original drafts are even less disciplined. Halleck, who is a lawyer, comes in and edits it heavily, especially the parts that intersect with American constitutional law. Wherever you get into, well, ironically for this conversation, where you ever get into martial law questions, where there are jurisdictional questions mm-hmm. arising out of the U.S. Constitution, Halleck has a heavy hand on those right. in the code itself. So Francis Lieber is an undisciplined thinker, a theorist, abstract, and all those things come out in the documents we found. So one we decided is an annotated version. And then the other document is a treatise on martial law, which we concluded was started by Francis Lieber the father, that hadn't been finished when Lieber dies. Francis Lieber the father dies in 1872 and was carried on by the son, Guido Norman, for some years afterwards. I don't know when he put it aside. He never finishes it, but he carries it forward as if to finish the father's project.
So I'm going to focus on the second, the manuscript on martial law, which is mostly what you focus on in the introduction. So how would you describe the theory? What is the theory of martial law embodied in this document?
So Lieber's intervening in both a kind of timeless set of questions and a set of very particular controversies immediate to the post-Civil War moment. And so as the architect of the law of war strategy for the Lincoln administration, much of it during the war.
Can I just stop you there?
Yeah.
I apologize. Tell us about that.
Yeah.
The architect of the law of war strategy, was he, I don't remember from your book, I should, was he working hand in hand with Lincoln? I mean, what was his relationship with Lincoln?
No. He's working with Halleck.
Halleck, right.
He's working with Halleck. He's at one remove from Lincoln. The time that we come closest to Lincoln working with the text, or Lincoln connected to the text that Lieber produces,
right.
Lieber knows Lincoln. They have met.
Yeah.
But the time that Lincoln comes closest to this project, the Law of War project, is in the retaliation order that Lincoln issues at the end of July 1863. Mm-hmm. Much of what's going on in the first 6 months of 1863 is working out prisoner exchange rules, and it's prisoner exchange rules for a world in which there are black soldiers. That's the hard part.
But you say in the introduction here that he was the architect of their Law of War strategy. Was that simply through the Lieber Code, or was he providing Halleck and others with, you know, continual advice and thoughts?
How did that manifest? It's a mix. I mean, one of the things going on is you get a sense for how radically different the executive branch is in the Civil War. There is, I mean, what are there, 10,000 lawyers in the Defense Department?
About,
I mean, whatever,
15,
right, whatever it is, you know, there's like nobody there. Right. There's nobody there. And so having someone like Lieber, who plays a critical role. So here are a couple examples of how Lieber is engaging law of war stuff during the Civil War. At the edges of the laws of war, he's a key go-between in the habeas controversy. He brings together the Philadelphia lawyer Binney with the Lincoln White House to put forward the most persuasive theory for why Lincoln can suspend habeas.
More persuasive than his attorney general.
Exactly.
It wasn't very persuasive.
Right. And Lieber is really involved in that conversation behind the scenes.
I see.
And then in 1862, Halleck and the White House turned to Lieber to produce a text on guerrilla warfare because mm-hmm. Missouri is a train wreck in 1862, and they've got to figure out who's in and who's out for privileges of combatant purposes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really undisciplined text that Lieber produces, but at its core, it's a really interesting idea. It's a functional account of who's a combatant and who's not.
So when law of war problems issues arose, he was consulted and involved.
Right. And he's also, the last piece, which is super interesting, is in particular, prosecutions in front of military commissions, they turn to him. This is after the code. You'll have JAGs, because the judge advocate corps is really built up during the war, and the judge advocates turn to Lieber both to his code and also just in letters and correspondence and say, what do we do here? And he's sometimes useful and sometimes not.
Right. So I interrupted you. You said that Lieber was intervening in both a timeless debate and a very specific Civil War debate.
Yeah, right.
That's where we were.
So the specific Civil War debate is the Milligan case, as just announced right in the wake of the war. As Andrew Johnson's announced the war's over, the Supreme Court's come in and decided the Milligan case, holding unconstitutional a military commission at the edges of the Union military's jurisdiction. And Francis Lieber sees that as an assault on the continuing project of bringing a close to the Civil War, and also as an assault on the work that he'd done during the war.
So flesh both of those out. Why was it an assault on the ending of the war, did you say?
On the effort to bring to bring Reconstruction to the right place. I'm hesitant. I mean, there's lots of fights about what the right place is.
But just explain the relationship. Explain why the impact of the Milligan decision. First of all, tell us what the Milligan decision held. Then tell us about the impact of the Milligan decision on Reconstruction and why Lieber was upset along that dimension.
So in 1866, the Milligan case at the U.S. Supreme Court reverses the conviction in a military commission of a Confederate sympathizer in Indiana named Landon Milligan. And the Supreme Court holds that since the courts of Indiana were open, and this is not an active battle situation, you can't have a military commission prosecute a U.S. citizen. You need an Article III court for that kind of a thing, or you need to be in the court system one way or another. And the military commissions are still a very active bunch of institutions in 1866. There are still lots and lots of soldiers, Union soldiers in the American South. The Klan has been created in the same year, and white Southern violence in a kind of guerrilla-like warfare is starting to resume. The Confederate armies are famous for not resorting to guerrilla warfare. Lee and folks like that disown it at the end of the war. But the Klan is a form of guerrilla warfare starting up again. And so the Union Army and its authority to do justice in the Reconstruction South, and this is pre-Congressional Reconstruction. This is white Southern governments that have been readmitted by Andrew Johnson. They're not going to do the work of policing violence against the recently freed people. And so the military commission is the hope for a whole group of folks in the North as something that will make emancipation real.
So in that sense, Milligan was a threat to emancipation.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Which I think many today's civil libertarians don't quite get.
Exactly. I mean, today we think of Milligan as the great civil liberties decision, and it was that. But in the context of the 1860s, it was seen as a hurdle to emancipation.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that Lieber was upset about it.
Yeah. So I think that much of Lieber's post-war writing, a lot of it doesn't appear in print because it's here in this manuscript, is an effort to rehabilitate and explain the form of the necessity power that he thought was the operating principle during the course of the Civil War, which he thinks continues after the Civil War. Now, whether what counts as after is itself a controversial question. Andrew Johnson thinks it's over in early April 1866. Congressional Republicans don't agree, many of them. So, but the question of the necessity power in 66, 67, and on for several years to come is a huge controversy, and Lieber's taking a position on that.
And what was his position? I mean, what was his basic beef with Milligan?
Yeah, Lieber's view is that in a passage in the Lieber Code, really one of the scariest, most striking passages in the Code, he says, to save the country is paramount to all other considerations. And that's a version of Lieber's necessity view that's unbounded, and it says it speaks clearly to something he strongly feels. He is a nationalist. He believes in the life of nations, and he thinks they're entitled to protect their own survival. Now, there are lots of ways in which there are a lot of scary things, potentially scary things in there.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a very restrained conception.
No, that's right. So what Lieber's going to do in this document is have to now reconcile that 1863 view, which apparently completely unbounded, although it's a little more complicated, right? Yeah. Talk about that.
Because he does mention some things you can't do.
That's exactly
even right. In martial law.
Right. There are very few.
But unbounded, if just so I understand, you mean that. What do you mean?
Well, to save the country is paramount to all other considerations. Taken seriously is unbounded. Now, we know, just as you suggested, we know that can't quite be right in the Code of 63, because, for example, torture is not permitted. Yeah.
He has a whole article, I can't remember, 16, I think it is, that lists a bunch of things you can't do in martial law, even once it's stated it shouldn't do or can't do.
Yeah, well, I want to say shouldn't. I mean, there are very few things in the Code that, if you press hard on the Code, are actually firm and fast prohibitions. We know that privately, Lieber, for example, thought poisons should be usable when necessity so required.
Right.
He thinks it's not palatable, and Halleck pushes back, and so the Code says never poisons. But Lieber's mostly the view that terrible things in warfare are things you ought to think twice about, but that necessity will permit at the end of the day. Executing the prisoners of war. You shouldn't do it, but necessity, but there might be a necessity carve out, a la Henry V.
So what is the limit on this?
So the torture rule is also perfidy. Perfidy is a never. White flags, violating the white flag, is you may not do it. Torture, you may not do it. And the martial law treatise, Will Smiley and I came to conclude, offers an account of what the limit might be that explains the torture prohibition. And the limit seems to be that states are authorized to do what's necessary to save themselves within reason, within reason. And now that's an abstract and shorthand limit. But we came to think that embedded in that reason was a whole world of constitutional values that was specific to the regime in question. That is, that you could do what's necessary to save yourself, but yourself is the constraint. And so the idea of reason contained the public reason of the relevant republic. And if torture was one of those things that would undo who it was you were, well, then torture was always out of bounds because you wouldn't be saving yourself with torture. You'd be undoing yourself by another means.
But is that what he meant, or did he mean, I have no reason to question what you just said, but here's another interpretation. So you don't think he meant it had to be reasonably necessary. You thought that there has to be some substantive content to reasonableness.
That's right. It's not just an instrumental rationality test.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not a means-ends connection. There's something about the identity of the republic.
I don't think he answered this question. How do you ascertain in a state of emergency when the fate of the nation of the sovereign is at stake, how do you ascertain what would undermine the identity of the state?
On the one hand, the Libres' failure, their collective failure, Francis and Norman, to answer that question is a major glaring flaw in the thesis. On the other hand, that's a really hard question to answer. And it might well be that setting up the framework is all you can do in advance. I'm open to that idea.
But he, just to put the torture prohibition in context, he also thought it was okay to kill, to do a lot of, but you call it a ferocious theory of military necessity. You could do a lot of really horrific things in the name of saving the state in an emergency situation. And then there are these sort of side constraints that pop up and demand explanation. And this is your explanation for it, or Lieber's explanation. It just doesn't sound terribly determinate at all.
Yeah. Well, it's culturally specific, for one thing, right? Yeah. It comes from a particular set of experiences. It's a judgment that's in the manuscript not very well defended. And I think the torture rule stands out in the Liber Code that way. Most humanitarian lawyers have overlooked the ferocity of the code, and so therefore missed the anomalousness of the torture constraint.
Yeah.
You know, if you read the code optimistically, then it bans all sorts of things, but actually it really doesn't.
Yeah.
So long as necessity warrants, it permits all sorts of stuff. So I my sense is that the beauty of the reasonableness rule is it explains that torture constraint. And I think one of the stories he often would refer to was warfare with Native Americans on the frontier. And he would describe interesting Native American cultural practices around warfare, which he did not understand. And there are actually lots of ways in which things that he thought were, to use a word he would have used, barbaric, were actually themselves parts of rituals of constraint, just distinctive and distinctive to a Native American tradition of warfare that he just couldn't, weren't legible to him. So he would tell about the burning, the ritual burning of an enemy captive and say that is not us. We couldn't do that. In fact, reciprocity and would not permit us to do that, because for us to do that would be to violate who it is that we are. I think that's one of the things at the core of the torture rule for him.
Yeah.
Is the sense that it's others do that.
So at times in the introduction, so at one point you say he didn't really have a theory of who decides. So, you know, that's all very nice as a theory, but if the executive is the one that decides, as opposed to a court, then it's not going to be much of a constraint, perhaps. But then in another part of the introduction, you said that he did think this was going to be an after-the-fact check.
Yeah.
As if, you know, when we're looking, whether it's in a court or whether it's the public, this is the test for whether you acted properly in an emergency, whether you actually acted reasonably with this particular conception of reasonableness. So comment on that.
Good. So yeah, he's at his weakest in some respects when you get into separation of power questions, or maybe I shouldn't say weakest, maybe I should say most idiosyncratic, and it has something to do with he's not trained as an American lawyer. It's not like he was at Harvard Law School learning from Justice Story. And so I think he thinks the executive is going to make these decisions in the first instance, because that's how it's going to go down. It's what he watched in the Civil War. But he's really convinced that judicial branch after the fact review will be the way this rule gets policed. He's worried about Congress's involvement here. He doesn't want Congress to be involved because he thinks Congress will change the rules and so cut out the courts.
Yeah, say more about this, because that's one of his most counterintuitive claims. Today, I think you mentioned this, today we think that the threat from excess in an emergency comes from the executive and that Congress is something of a restraint. We more or less think that. We certainly thought that after 9/11. But he seemed much more worried about Congress than the executive. Can you flesh that out
some? Yes, you're exactly right. And it's a little bit of a puzzle. I think there's two reasons why. One that he would have given, and then the other that I think we can see in historical retrospect. I think he would have said, Congress is the body that makes the laws. Congress is, and now maybe he's a little, he's thinking of a parliamentary tradition maybe here, crispest there. Congress is deciding on the identity of the Republic. The laws that make up the laws and Constitution of the United States are the identity of the Republic. It's not some racial group or some pre-existing national identity. We are what our laws make us, is his way of thinking about the American Republic. And so Congress could change the identity of the Republic in a way the executive branch can't. That's his view.
I'm not sure it makes sense. It seems that an out-of-control executive, is the idea that Congress can formally change the law in a way that the executive branch can't?
That's his view. And, you know, pre-New Deal, that's not quite as crazy an idea as you might think.
And he also seemed to think, I think you suggested this, that executive action was more likely to be subject to judicial review than congressional action, maybe because he thought Congress could control jurisdiction or change the applicable law in court.
Right, and
And it sounds like he wasn't terribly, and maybe in the 19th century this is appropriate, terribly, as you said, versed in constitutional law.
Right.
And the idea of constitutional constraints.
Yeah, all those things. The one thing that in historical retrospect I think makes his view a little bit more explicable, you know, partly it's the Prussian origins, he just doesn't quite get it sometimes, but in historical retrospect, the executive branch that he's interacting with is tiny. I mean, it's just not, they need him, right? For them to produce, I mean, think of the, I only dimly understand, interagency processes that have helped produce new law of armed conflict documents over the last couple of years in the United States military. I mean, the Lincoln administration has no one to turn to, and so they go to this guy who's lecturing on the laws of armed conflict at Columbia Law School. Right. And they say, hey, will you do this for us? So the executive branch doesn't have the capacity than to do what it does now.
I mean, the Justice Department really didn't get formed until the decade after. I think it was the
1870s. That's right.
So this manuscript was written in the 1860s, mid to late, and what light, if any, does it shed on Lincoln's famous July 4th, 1861 speech? And if you could just remind us briefly what that was.
Right, good. So Lieber's role is 1860s and into the first 2 years of the 1870s, and then he then dies. It's hard for Will and me to figure out how much the son adds in decades after. Uh-huh. There are references to events and cases decided in the 1870s and even the 1880s. So the son is just working on this thing over time. Partly, I think it helps explain why it's such a mess in the archives. So that's the document. But I do. Will and I suggest in our introduction that it sheds some interesting new light on that July 1861 moment where Lincoln's before Congress. And Lincoln says, many of your listeners know the phrase verbatim, and I'm terrible with strings of words. So Lincoln says, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to preserve every other law? I'm supposed to preserve let this law go away and have the whole country collapse? I mean, all the laws but one, right?
And that was a claim of necessity. Is that right, do you think?
Yeah, that's a kind of necessity claim. And I guess I think that the way that famous moment, you know, which I just butchered, has come down to us is as a necessity claim, is that at base, when the Republic is at risk, the right actors, let's say the president here, can do what's required to save as much of the Republic as possible. And there's a kind of That's a necessity story that has no limits built into it. And what Lieber's text helped willingly see was that that imagines that there's a republic outside of the rules, which can be saved if the president takes dramatic steps. But the way Lincoln actually puts it, he's talking about a system of rules. There's no existence outside of these rules for this republic. It's a republic constituted by rules. And so what the executive branch's engagement with those rules is, entails hard judgment calls and entails reference to the basic reason of the republic. That was the thought.
And as I recall that speech, it was embedded in the Constitution and in legal structures. He defended habeas corpus, the controversial argument, but he defended his right to suspend habeas corpus. And he famously acknowledges, this is my interpretation, I don't know if you agree with it, that some of the steps he took may have been extra legal, but they didn't go beyond Congress's power, and that Congress could ratify it after the fact, which he asked it to do. He explained the reasons why he gave reasons why he needed to take these steps. And so it was all took place in sort of embedded legal culture, which is my way of understanding what you're basically saying that Lieber said. Right. Is that right?
I think that's right. And I guess there's the popular conception of that moment, which I honestly think is in the William Rehnquist book too. So it's not just a popular conception that, look, when it comes down to it, if all the laws but one are going to get broken, you can do what you need to do. I think that's too simple an account of it. And that embeddedness, which is a great word, is the better way to understand it. And now that doesn't tell us what to do in that moment, but it reminds us that we're not protecting something that exists outside the rules. We're actually engaged in an effort to manage the rules from within, because that's all we have.
Great. Last question. Is this a document that sheds light on late 19th century American legal culture and helps us have a richer understanding of the laws of war and emergency power after the Civil War, during and after the Civil War? I mean, what is it? Does it have a contemporary significance, or is it just this odd, incomplete manuscript that sheds light on the moment?
So by contemporary significance, you mean now for 21st century?
Yeah. Well, you're an historian. Yeah. You're not supposed to answer questions that, but go for it.
I'm a historian in law school, right. it's an occupational hazard.
Right, exactly.
I've been struck by the changed context over time, because I discovered that I found this document in like 2011, it seemed, I thought at that moment that this was speaking powerfully to our context. It was a moment in which talk about nuclear proliferation, terrorist organizations produced real questions about what would count as existential threats and the like. Those things, I'm sure, are still there, whether they're in the news as much or not. Right now, the emergency story is about all these ways in which the executive branch is able to pull the emergency card thanks to congressional legislation over the decades since the early 70s. And I don't know that this text has to do very much with that emergency story. That's a different valence. I think this is about those moments where national security crises are posing real questions about how government actors and how government officials should operate. The historian in me, I'm interested in the late 19th century, which your question adverted to at first. And what comes up then is something that is not in this text at all, which is a martial law and labor conflict. I mean, so what's going to happen by the 1880s, 1890s is labor conflict is raising questions about whether the president can send in troops to rescue the railroads or whatever. And this text is really not engaging that. Although some of its logic, that fierce necessity, could be invoked to license all sorts of labor interventions and is in fact invoked for that.
Great. Okay. Thanks very much.
This is awesome, Jack. Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to John Witt. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. You can purchase Lawfare t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Pachehao. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.